This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran strongly denies baseless allegations by the US and the UK, accusing Tehran of being behind a July cyber attack against Albania. Israeli forces fatally shoot another Palestinian youth in a raid on a village near the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And defying the international outcry, Israel's Prime Minister rejects the possibility of prosecuting the soldier who fatally shot Palestinian journalists. Thank you for joining us. Iran has vehemently denied baseless allegations by the US and the UK accusing Tehran of masterminding a cyber attack against Albania. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the US and the UK are not in a position to level such accusations against Iran. He added that both countries have in the past supported numerous cyber attacks against Iran's infrastructure and even its nuclear facilities. Kanani said, Iran is ready to give a powerful response to any political adventurism against the country on the basis of such false allegations. Earlier on Wednesday, Albania announced cutting ties with Iran, giving Iranian diplomats 24 hours to leave the country. Tehran claimed Tehran was behind a July cyber attack. The White House then warned of further action against Iran. The new British Foreign Secretary also blamed Iran for the cyber attack against the Albanian government. Iran says unilateral promises by countries about stopping nuclear tests cannot replace the nuclear disarmament unless they turn into legally binding obligations. Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, made the remark while addressing a UN meeting on the nuclear disarmament. She noted that 26 years after the extension of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, the world is still awaiting a halt on nuclear tests. Ershadi added that Iran regrets the delay in halting nuclear tests and considers it a major reason for the failure of the 10th NPT review conference. She said Iran believes that immediate nuclear disarmament is the best way to save the world from the risk posed by nuclear weapons. Ershadi said the same approach must be taken to Israel's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, which threatens security and stability of West Asia. Iran's top general has warned against growing military cooperation between the US and Israel in the Persian Gulf region and its negative consequences for the regional countries. During our news review program, we discussed this issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Iran's top general warns of ramifications of the growing military partnership between the U.S. and the Israeli regime in the Persian Gulf region. Major General Mohammad Bagheri says the U.S. military has tried to make up for the withdrawal of its warships from the region by connecting the, quote, child-killer Israeli military to the U.S. Central Command. He said the cooperation will provide the Israeli regime with America's spying facilities. The chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces noted that the partnership will increase threats to Iran. Bagheri, however, has warned regional countries hosting American and Israeli forces against any threat to Iran's security. He underlined that the Islamic Republic has always urged its neighbors not to rely on foreigners for regional security. Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh is a political commentator who joins us from Tehran. We also have Don Dabar, a radio host, journalist, and political activist, joining us from New York. Welcome to you both. So tell us exactly this configuration that Israel and the U.S. have concocted here. Is it correct to conclude that Israel, through CENTCOM, which obviously is American-run, of which there are U.S. military bases in countries in the region, will now be able to militarily execute what it wants based on the bases that it has in these various countries which are the Persian Gulf Arab countries, which hence maybe explains why U.S. and Israel are so keen on this so-called normalization between these countries.
Well, I think it's a reflection that, you know, the fact that this is becoming more and more an integrated command, you know, essentially the so-called IDF, being partnering, quote-unquote, with CENTCOM, which is the central command of the U.S. military, is a reflection of the condition of hostilities at this point that actually constitute a war with multiple fronts. You have a front on Russia's border with Ukraine. You have a front in Syria with the U.S. occupation there and, you know, regular Israeli raids. You have a front in Yemen. You have a front still smoldering in Iraq. The entire area is in a state of war. And as the war becomes more and more actualized, you're going to see a more and more obvious or public viewing of the integration of command in these, you know, in these areas. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing this. You look at Albania, what's happening there. You're looking at the situation with the various types of computers, whatever you call the electronic espionage and attacks and warfare, and the ongoing media battle where Iran's media has been frozen out of the international, you can't broadcast in these large pieces of territory. It's clear that there's a war that's ongoing. We're not falling into one, we're in one. And the fact that we see an integrated command now in front of us shouldn't surprise anyone. I don't really think it's a change of anything other than visibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, Seyed Mostafa Khoshesh, how do you see this? I mean, Iran obviously it does not like it. I'm curious whether it's Israel now part of CENTCOM in a sense or operating through CENTCOM, which I'm guessing has, as I asked Don DeBar, that the U.S. has these military bases in regional countries, and therefore perhaps there was a push for normalization of ties. Maybe this is part of the reason.
Hello, and thanks for having me. That's true, exactly. The United States is on decline, and it means to create a World War II-like situation and environment in the whole world. So it has started some kind of proxy warfare against the Russians at the cost of the Europeans. Also, they have escalated tensions in the Taiwan Strait and escalated tensions against China at the cost of Taiwan. And they plan to do the same now that the JCPOA talks has entered another phase, another statement, and another phase of war of willpower. They have escalated tensions against Iran under the same pattern. Some might believe that that the United States, because it's decreasing forces and redeploying to the South China Sea, and it doesn't want to leave its Arab allies in the region disappointed. So they have started some kind of reconnaissance mission in the Strait, in the Strait of Hormuz, through this, sea drones, to collect information to help them and to reduce numbers of forces and regional, bases, but to make use of electronics and, semi-automatic, robotic things and by just advanced technology. But this is not the case. Intel shows that they mean to spy on the Iranians in the patrolling the region in order to find suitable route to spread Israeli warships and also submarines into the Persian Gulf. This is not going to be tolerated by Iran, as has been warned repeatedly by chief Iranian officials and army commanders. One of the tactics used by the United States is that they, once they are redeploying to the South China Sea, they mean to start a coalition, Arab-Israeli coalition, to be aided and assisted by the NATO allies in the Persian Gulf, and to replace themselves with them in order to slow down Iran's regional growth, in their absence. So Initially, it started under Donald Trump in the last 1 or 2 years after normalization of ties in the last couple of years of his presidency. But they failed. As soon as the Israeli submarines and warships meant to leave the Red Sea and through the Bab el-Mandeb, the Iranian army sent flotillas to confront them. At least two confrontations happened, and the Israelis moved back. Then they started the war games with their Arab allies, Israeli Arab war games. Some 20 countries or more were present and participated in that. And then now they're thinking of how to spread to the Arab Sea from the Red Sea, then to the Sea of Oman and the Persian Gulf, and they are spying on Iranian forces. And let's remember that Iran has the lengthiest coastline, and it's officially internationally in charge of the Strait of Hormuz that happens to be on the Iranian side, actually. And it's in charge of managing and controlling safe shipping in the region. And the United States or others should receive permission from the Iranians. That has been the case always. It means that they are only allowed to have safe passage through the strait. And they cannot impose or meddle with the management of this trade. Okay. That's what they are trying to do.
Thank you for that. Say Mustafa Khoshesh, political commentator, Don DeBar, pleasure, radio host, journalist, and political activist from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this news interview. Thanks for tuning in.
Moving on, Israel's deadly violence against Palestinians shows no sign of abating. The latest victim is a youth fatally shot by Israeli forces near the West Bank city of Ramallah. According to local sources, the new fatality came after Israeli forces opened fire on Palestinians during a raid on a village in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli army says he was hit after attacking a regime soldier. Israel has stepped up deadly raids across the Palestinian territories over the past months. According to a Palestinian rights group, Israel has killed more than 110 people in the West Bank and Gaza Strip since the beginning of 2022. Israel will not prosecute a soldier who possibly shot dead veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh back in May. That's according to the regime's prime minister, Yair Lapid. Added that Israeli soldiers have the full backing of the regime. The comments came 2 days after the Israeli army admitted in a report that there was a high possibility that Abu Akleh was accidentally shot by one of its soldiers. The Palestinian Authority and Abu Akleh's family have denounced the report. The veteran reporter was wearing a bulletproof vest marked press and a helmet when she was shot in the head during an Israeli army raid in the Jenin refugee camp. Russian natural gas deliveries to EU members have dropped by 48% so far this year. That's according to Russian energy giant Gazprom. The energy corporation said the decline totals 49% if the UK is included. Gazprom had announced on Friday that the Nord Stream 1 pipeline would remain halted due to a leak detected there. It said the pipeline would not resume supply until repaired fully. Nord Stream 1 is the single biggest pipeline for Russian gas deliveries to Europe and has the capacity to provide the continent with 55 billion cubic meters of gas per year. But Russia and the EU are on a collision course over the supplies. The EU is mulling to impose a price cap on Russian gas. President Vladimir Putin has warned of halting oil and gas in case of capped is imposed. Newly appointed British Prime Minister Liz Truss faces grilling from the opposition Labour Party during the first session of Parliament after taking over the Tory leadership. Truss sparred with Labour leader Keir Starmer on the country's energy and cost of living crises. Truss said her cabinet will make sure the new energy plan supports businesses and the people. She pledged to use more domestic oil, gas, and nuclear energy to deal with the current crisis. The Premier said her cabinet needs to address energy costs for businesses, adding that she is against imposing a windfall tax for energy companies to help tackle the price hike.
It's been dubbed the most right-wing cabinet for a generation, formed after new PM Liz Truss's fulsome support for her predecessor and a purge of defeated rival Rishi Sunak loyalists. Some of the familiar faces, Kwasi Kwarteng, a free marketeer and Truss's ideological soulmate, confirmed as chancellor. Ex-leadership candidate Suelos Braverman, admired by the right wing for attacks on, quote, woke politics, appointed home secretary. Staunch ally James Cleverly, promoted as foreign minister. On his entree, Ukraine and fixing relations with the EU, strained after Brexit, among other things. Close friend Teresa Coffey will be deputy prime minister and health secretary. The National Health Service is reeling under a staff and cash crisis. And another carryover from the Johnson administration, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the man who blamed the energy crisis in the UK on climate alarmists, will be business and energy secretary.
What we therefore have is a very clearly defined agenda with Liz Truss surrounding herself by people she thinks will be loyal to her and will share some quite central policy objectives, which I'd suggest are sharper than those of her predecessor.
The makeup of the Truss team goes against her pledge to use what she called all the fantastic talents of the Conservative Party.
Liz Truss won less than 60% of the Conservative Party membership vote, and when she threw her hat in the ring for party leadership, she won fewer than a third of the Conservative MPs' votes, which means that she could have done herself a favor by trying to appeal to as wide a base of parliamentary support as possible.
Especially because she will need her party's support for her plans for her three priorities, the economy, energy, and the NHS.
So they might grumble in private, but they'll show the impression of unity in public. The biggest issue, though, for her is that if she does controversial things in legislative terms, which MPs think aren't going to work, then she could have problems.
The 56th UK Prime Minister takes up the reins of power as the UK toils under spiraling levels of inflation, skyrocketing energy costs, an economy almost certainly in recession, and public services on the brink. It remains to be seen if she and her cabinet can deliver on her promises. Saeed Bourizza, London.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for joining us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Members of the hate group Patriot Front were seen marching in downtown Indianapolis on Saturday afternoon, 3rd of September, as they chanted Reclaim America, according to videos circulating online. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Fatima Khaled. The article has been published by Newsweek magazine and is titled Neo-Nazi Patriot Front Marches in Indiana Yelling Reclaim America. Members of the hate group Patriot Front were seen marching in downtown Indianapolis on Saturday afternoon, 3rd of September, as they chanted Reclaim America, according to videos currently circulating online. A number of videos appeared on Twitter showing the group marching together, with some beating on drums while others carried signs and could be heard chanting. One video of the march was posted by Twitter user Pope Benedictus, who called the group Nazis, gained 1.7 million views as of Sunday afternoon, 4th of September. The group published videos and updates about their march on their Telegram channel, including one post that read, "Patriot Front activists are currently marching in Indianapolis, Indiana, in recognition of Labor Day." According to the Patriot Front's website, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Massachusetts, and Michigan are their top five states for all of their activities. On Saturday, 3rd of September, Destiny Wells, a Democrat running for Indiana's Secretary of State, tweeted, "I heard there were 30 racists down the street earlier today, while there were hundreds of pro-union folks a block away celebrating Labor Fest. This is literally fascism versus democracy. The choice isn't hard. Vote blue in 2022. Destiny Wells was standing a few blocks away from the march, where she was attending a rally held by groups supporting unionization on Monument Circle, local news station WISH-TV reported. "People in Indiana and across the nation are absolutely aghast at this blatant demonstration of neo-fascist ideals, without regard for civilized American society as we know it today. History has taught us of the Ku Klux Klan's similar tactics of marching down the main street of Indiana, and the marcher's hateful propaganda was met with disgust," Destiny Wells told Newsweek on Sunday. In a separate press release emailed to Newsweek, Wells's media office stated that the Democratic candidate condemns the march, which has led to outcry from Hoosiers across the state, in a display that again puts Indiana in the national spotlight during a historic election year, exposing efforts designed to systematically tear down America's electoral system. Destiny Wells added, "I do not believe their objectives will ever have a place in civilized American society." One question that many are asking is, who are the Patriot Front? Patriot Front is a Texas-based white supremacist group that disbanded from another white supremacist group and neo-Nazi organization, Vanguard America, in September of 2017, following the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, according to the Anti-Defamation League. Patriot Front justified this ideology of hate and intolerance under the guise of preserving the ethnic and cultural origins of its members' European ancestors, according to the Anti-Defamation League. Characterized by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a white nationalist hate group, Patriot Front uses theatrical rhetoric and activism to tout the idea of establishing a white ethno-state in the United States. In June, a viral video allegedly showed members of Patriot Front participating in a training program where they were seen practicing marches. Also in June, 31 members of the group, including its leader Tom Russo, were arrested for allegedly conspiring to riot near a pride event in Idaho. Newsweek has reached out to the Counter-Extremism Project for comment.
Food for Thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder over a famous saying narrated by the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him, regarding his illustrious ancestress, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Poverty shall not enter a house inhabited by people having the names Muhammad from among men and Fatima from among women.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for people's personality. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of respect of people's personality in the Islamic lifestyle when we talk about the conditions of calling for good and forbidding evil. The second condition which we must look after in calling for good and forbidding evil when we want to perform such an obligation, it is necessary to respect. To have a respect for people's personality. Generally, we see that we pay attention towards our own respect. We expect people respecting us, and they should pay attention to us, and we have respect for our own self. Similarly, the others also have this respect, and it is in the fitrah or the nature of the mankind that he gives or pays attention to himself. But paying attention to the other's personality is from the Islamic lifestyle. In the Islamic teachings, it is necessary that we respect others, and with that respect, we should call others towards the good, and we should stop them from performing evil. If we cannot respect others, and if we do not have any respect towards the others' personalities, then obviously when we perform the calling for good and forbidding the evil, it will make people running away from us. We cannot We cannot bring people closer to our salt. We cannot attract people towards the goodness. And that is what Islam is saying, that you must respect, you must have the respect for the people's personality, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the conditions of calling for good and forbidding evil, and we reached to the second condition, which is respect for people's personality. And we said that it is necessary because Islam pays attention to this topic and it stops others. Even we have that the prophets and the saints, they used to stop some people from performing this obligation, which is calling for good and forbidding evil. Why? Because these people did not have a good personality. They were not respecting others. They did not reform themselves. So there are conditions. So the second condition is you must have the respect for people's personality in order to perform the calling for good and stopping from evil. We have in history, we have a narration that one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he used to perform sins sometimes. He used to perform mistakes in his life. He had it. And he used to do it on and off in his life. But there was a time when he came to Imam alayhi salam and he asked him for the help, and there when he asked him for the help, Imam alayhi salam has said to him that innal hasana min kulli ahadin hasanun. When someone performs a good deed, it is good. When someone performs good, it is good. Wa innahu minka ahsanu. But when you perform it, it is better. It's not good, it is better, it is higher. Limakanika minna. Why? Because you're related to us. Because you're known as our companion. That's why when you perform a good, it is better. وَإِنَّ الْقَبِيحَ مِنْ كُلِّ أَحَدٍ قَبِيحٍ. But when someone performs a bad deed, it is a bad deed. وَإِنَّهُ مِنْكَ أَقْبَهُ. But when you perform something bad, it is worse. It is not just bad. So this is how Imam has explained him, that he has made a respect for him, that remember that you're connected to us, and if someone performs good who is connected to us, it is known as better. But if you're performing a bad evil or the bad deeds, it is worse. So our followers must stop from performing bad deeds, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-coloured foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colours mixed were by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food coloring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves its purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre.
Tehran Saray Gallery takes part in a massive art exhibition in South Korea, bringing Iran's leading and emerging artist to the Asian market. Works from six Iranian painters are displayed at the event, where hundreds of galleries account for more than $50 million in sales annually. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Seoul's annual global art exhibition has been reinvigorated this year with additional events and a most certain boost in attendance. The Korea International Art Fair continues an evolution that began with its launch back in 2002. This year features 164 galleries and more international exhibitors than ever before. That growing cosmopolitan experience and this region's growth as an art market hub is what brought a premier Iranian gallery to Seoul.
When we started this gallery, we had the big goal to just introduce Middle Eastern artists and Iranian artists to all over the world. So when you want to introduce artists, you cannot forget South Korea and Far East as well.
Sarai had participated in last year's art fair with paintings purchased by local Korean collectors. Expanding on that success at the event, and as Iranian artists are growing in international stature, Hassan Saradipour decided to display works from six Iranian artists at this year's event.
Our gallery focuses on the established and emerging artists. This artist, Abbas Nasashamlu, he just want to show that how the nature and how the human can affect to each other, how this experience can bring it on the canvas, on the paper.
The massive exhibition featured paintings, although there were various multimedia and sculpture installations. As South Korean living standards have risen, more people have time and money to spend on such events. Their taste in art has also become more sophisticated.
South Korea used to lack art galleries compared to other countries. There was a serious lack of love for this level of culture. However, now these events, I think, create opportunities for more people to gain such appreciation.
For the first time this year, Freeze Art Fair in Seoul exhibited works from 110 galleries, including Picasso, other 20th century masters, and contemporary talents. Frank Smith, Seoul.
An Iranian movie wins the grand prize for the best film in this year's Moscow International Film Festival. In its international debut, No Prior Appointment won the Best Film and the Best Actress awards. The movie is a product of Farabi Cinema Foundation and directed by Behruz Shoaibi in Iran in 2021. It is the story of a girl named Yasaman who returns to Iran from Germany after her father's death. A short stay in her father's hometown and meeting those who know him leads her to a new understanding of humans and the concept of death. The 44th edition of the Moscow International Film Festival was held this year from September 4 to 11. Animals, no matter pets or wild, are more vulnerable to drowning or dying in resulting floods and mudslides. A veterinarian school in Pakistan is offering free treatment for animals injured in the recent devastating floods. The veterinary surgery department of Sindh Agriculture University has set up a makeshift animal hospital as flooding hit humans and animals alike in the surrounding area. Volunteers have been providing anything from surgery to medicine and even ultrasounds to the animals free of cost. People from flood-affected areas can be seen bringing their farm animals such as goats, donkeys, buffaloes, and cows to the center. The worst floods in history have killed an estimated 800,000 farm animals. But there were many heartwarming videos trolling on social media showing people come to rescue animals being stuck hopelessly.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones, which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and a broad Nineveh province that includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month. The floating cinema of unknown waters is back in the Italian city of Venice, and spectators are getting buoyant to reach the annual Open Sea Film Festival. On board a rowing boat, a motorboat, gondolas, and whatever capable of floating, spectators sail to the shallows behind the Giudecca Island for this one-of-a-kind cinematic experience. The audience can watch the program from their own boat or a barge with chairs for those without floating transportation. The event consists of a series of screenings, performances, and presentations on a floating platform and is held for 12 nights in the Venetian Lagoon.
bird species has been discovered on the southernmost islands of the Americas. Biologists are baffled.
Discovering new bird species is very, very difficult and rare because the world has been more focused on observing birds. Therefore, this means the discovery site is unique in the sub-Antarctic zone, on which Chile has important sovereignty. This raises the importance of caring for the environment and unique ecosystems, as these sites will allow us to carry out research on climate change, new species and behaviors.
The tiny bird weighs only 16 grams and has a large beak with black and yellow streaks along its body. Researchers say the animal is a subcategory of a species typically found in the Patagonia forest and inhabits tree trunks. But the newly discovered cousin has surprised scientists as it learned to burrow and live in a harsh tundra climate with bitter temperatures. The Diego Ramirez archipelago, where the bird was found, is an isolated bit of land. It also lacks mammalian predators and woody plants. Biologists and researchers from Chilean universities and various academic centers studied the birds for 6 years before announcing the new species. The next moonshot is finally getting closer. NASA says it's ready to test its next generation rocket ship on an epic launch set for August the 29th as part of its mission to send people to the moon.
This new deep space exploration system is going to take us back to the moon and to new science discoveries that we can't even imagine yet. NASA is about to make history with this first flight of the Artemis program.
The mega rocket combines the Space Launch System, or SLS, and the Orion crew capsule it will carry to space. The rocket is due to blast off for a test drive from the U.S. base Kennedy Space Center, sending an empty crew capsule around the moon and back to the Earth. The Artemis 1 test flight is planned to take 6 weeks. It's meant to rigorously stress the systems to determine whether the vehicle is ready to safely carry astronauts. The program aims to establish a long-term lunar colony as a stepping stone to the even more ambitious future voyages that will send people to Mars. The SLS represents the biggest new vertical launch system NASA has built since those flown in the 1960s and 70s. This story will tell you about what could be the bright side of climate change, and that's the discovery of dinosaur tracks dating back to 113 million years ago. The tracks were found in the U.S. state of Texas, where drought has dried up parts of Paluxy River. Experts say the tracks belong to a two-legged dinosaur with small arms and weighing 7 tons. They say dinosaurs made the prints as they roamed muddy areas over 100 million years ago. The prints were then covered over with sediment due to a flood. And after that, they turned into limestone, protecting the prints. The experts say the tracks have not been seen either before or in decades. Age does not matter, it's the heart that counts. A Guatemalan female footballer has proved that there is no point one should worry about the age. 57-year-old Alma Salazar has a passion for soccer and takes care of her team's goalpost. Known as Flying Granny, she launches herself and deflects a ball that's looking for the nets. The passion for the sport was born when she was 19 years old. She started training with a men's team where she often found a place as a goalkeeper. Since then, Alma has played for several professional and amateur football clubs. In her room that overlooks a local stadium, Alma keeps the trophies she has won on a table, most of them as the least defeated goalkeeper. Locals praise her as an unbeatable goalkeeper.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
How Saudi Arabia tries to whitewash its crimes against humanity by the means of sports has been challenged. Recently, the kingdom's sports washing of war crimes in Yemen and domestic human rights abuses have been criticized by anti-war activists. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. The website of Truthout wrote, peace activists recently challenged Saudi Arabia's sports washing of war crimes in Yemen and domestic human rights abuses by protesting outside and over a Massachusetts golf tournament funded by the repressive kingdom. Members of Massachusetts Peace Action and supporters rallied at the Bolton Fairgrounds in Lancaster, site of the shuttle bus to the LIV golf tournament at the International Golf Club in Bolton. The professional golf tour is financed by the Public Investment Fund, Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. Demonstrators held signs with messages including, Saudi money is blood money, and Saudi Arabia kills journalists and kids in Yemen, while an airplane circled over the event trailing a banner reading, Bolton rejects Saudi blood money. The Saudi bombing and blockade of Yemen has brought devastation to the people of that country. Paul Shannon, who chairs Massachusetts Peace Action's Middle East Working Group, said in a statement. He added, that destruction has been enabled by our country's support for the Saudi invasion and by bombs, planes, and missiles sold to the Saudis by U.S. military contractors like Lockheed, Boeing, and Raytheon. Protester Ali Zereni of Bolton told WCVB, I'm outraged that it's my town that's hosting a golf tournament that's funded by the terrorist and murderous regime in Saudi Arabia. Another demonstrator, Paul Carver, asserted that golf should not be used to promote a government like Saudi Arabia that is doing these things in the world to people. He added, we do not condone collaboration with a murderous dictator like the Crown Prince. In addition to peace activists, relatives of people killed in September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States, which were possibly backed by some Saudi officials, have called out LIV golfers as well as former President Donald Trump for hosting LIV event at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. While campaigning in 2016, Trump blamed Saudi Arabia for 9/11. However, once elected, he behaved like every U.S. president by maintaining friendly relations with the oil-rich kingdom's rulers and selling them hundreds of millions of dollars in arms for use in the U.S.-backed coalition war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people while displacing, starving, and sickening millions more. At the recent protest, Massachusetts Peace Action also handed out pamphlets thanking the professional golfers who have eschewed the tournament so as not to be associated with an event created with millions of dollars from one of the most repressive regimes on the face of the earth. Also, the website of Nation wrote, "Is the kingdom of golf being used to sport wash the kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Or is it the other way around? After all, what other major sport could use a sandstorm of Middle Eastern murder and human rights abuses to obscure its own history of bigotry and greed? In fact, not since the 1936 Berlin Olympics was used to cosmeticize Nazi Germany's atrocities and promote Aryan superiority have sports and an otherwise despised government collaborated so blatantly to enhance their joint international standings. Golf symbolized reactionary greed even before the Saudis entered the picture. For starters, its competitors are among the only professional athletes ranked purely by the cash prizes they have won, and the leading golfers invariably earn far more from endorsements and speaking engagements. Golf has long been retrograde, exclusionary, and money-obsessed. To put that in perspective, the estimated revenue of the Professional Golf Association in 2019 was $1.5 billion, and it boasts a non-profit status that's sometimes been questioned. Lucrative as it is, it also proved distinctly vulnerable to an attack by an oil-soaked autocracy that, in warming up to invade golf, had already invested in Formula One racing, esports, wrestling, and its most recent controversial purchase, a British Premier League soccer team, which provoked protests from fans and Amnesty International. Still, the Saudis' move on golf has even bolder, more ambitious, and somehow almost ordained to happen. Unlike football and baseball, which are convenient amalgams of socialism for the owners in their collusive cooperation and dog-eat-dog capitalism for the players and other personnel, golf is a more of a monarchy along the lines of Saudi Arabia.
Midstream.